Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by the wise, venerable, and gracious Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I mean, called many things, but never gracious.
I like to spice it up, our introduction sometimes.
Well, you know, one
And
takes what one can get.
indeed. And the long, clever, and late, but not in the dead sense, Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for accommodating.
No problem. Right. Let us start off today with something that I actually talked about on Sihle Ngobeyi's Big Daddy Liberty show last night a little bit, which you can check out if you're interested. And that is a new piece of firearms control legislation is coming down the pike, so to speak. And oh boy, it doesn't look like a good one. Now let us, well, I think we can get into the sort of larger arguments just now about why gun ownership is something that should be protected, because I think there are people, in many people in South Africa who don't see why it's so important. But let's just start off by talking about what exactly is contained in this legislation and why there's cause for concern. So, Terence, you're a firearms owner and you have some knowledge in this area. Could you tell us a little bit about what the government's plans are when it comes to firearms legislation?
Okay.
Oh, you appear to have lost Terence. I think his microphone fell out there for a second. No, Terence, you are still muted.
Hear me now. Here we
Yes,
go.
there we go. All right, take it away, sir.
Right. It's a little bit vague, but in broad brush strokes, the new bill will probably seek to remove the category of self-defense from the Firearms Act. In other words, you will not be able to own a firearm with the intention of using it to protect yourself. There are also other things that tighten up the ability of sport shooters and hunters to own weapons. For instance, if you're an occasional hunter or an occasional shooter, you'll need to be able to prove that you actually have some sort of designated spot where you can go hunting or shooting. So it's being speculated you'll have to produce a letter, let's say, from a game farm or from a shooting range. There is also an interesting change. It also looks like there could be an interesting change to the wording, which will specify that you may only carry out your shooting where it is safe to do so. And what the interpretation that I'm reading on this is that this will preclude you from using, let's say, a weapon you own for hunting for self-defense, since self-defense simply won't be permissible with a firearm. So yeah, this is something that has popped up from time to time. I think that the ANC, if we go right back to the 1990s, was talking about a gun-free society. And Minister Cele has said it'd be wonderful if no private citizens owned firearms, if they were only in the hands of the security forces who stand paladin-like between us and chaos. If one goes back about 2, 3 years, there was a mooted amendment to the Firearms Control Act that contained most of these provisions. Which was also removing self-defense. On a political level, what I think is happening here is that essentially the government is going for broke. It's seen this massive disruption to pretty much all aspects of society through COVID, and it believes that this is a once in a generation to get through a legislative program that would otherwise be resisted. Expropriation without compensation, NHI, and I think the effect of confiscation of most firearms is likely in the mix as a result of this.
Very concerning. But let's talk very briefly about why I think this issue is why you should care about this issue, even if you don't like guns, even if you don't own a firearm. So I think the first thing to state is that one of the big problems in South Africa, there's this idea pushed by the kind of gun control groups like Gun Free SA, that private ownership of firearms leads to crime, leads to criminals being armed with firearms, because criminals, as we know, often target privately owned firearms, steal them, and then they use those to commit other crimes. But I'd argue that that's relatively small part of the problem. I'll point you all to that video. I'm sure many people saw that viral video of the guys evading a hijacking kind of on the road.
Phone Josh.
Right.
Exactly. And Lloyd. Don't forget
Lloyd. Those guys, right? They were, as far as I could tell, not being shot at by firearms that anyone can own legally. Right? It was like automatic stuff and big some big guns there. So, you know, those kind of guys, there are a lot of people who are very heavily armed, completely outside the system, who didn't get their firearms from someone. And on top of that, as we know, the cops lose firearms all the time. The cops have been accused in some cases of selling firearms to criminals. So disarming the population is very unlikely to solve the crime problem. But Gabriel, I want to get to you. Why are some other reasons why, you know, everyone should care about legal firearms ownership and this piece of legislation?
Yeah, I think here's a way that people care that I think can be distracting, a utopian way. So Japan has got almost no private firearm ownership. Almost no one gets shot. And you think to yourself, wouldn't it be nice to be like Japan? Then you think to yourself, well, wouldn't it also be nice to be like Switzerland, where there's very widespread gun ownership, but also no one gets shot, very, very low crime rates. And I think that if you bring out that contrast, you do get a sense of maybe guns aren't in themselves the problem. The problem is something else. And you also get the sense that there's a difference between advocating for everyone to have a gun or more people to have guns on the one side, and I'm not particularly keen on that, to advocating for everyone having the right to go through a process with legal checks where they have to be responsible people, they have to know how to use the thing, they have to know the rules of engagement and so on. Everyone is willing to go through that process having a gun to defend themselves. And I think the argument against that, the argument against letting citizens apply for a license and have a gun to defend themselves, is a paternalistic one as opposed to a liberal argument. The paternalistic argument is that human beings can't be trusted. And if you let people have guns, they're not going to take care of them and they're going to leak out. And it'll all just be worse because you have more lethal weapons in the general population. And so you must keep guns out of people's hands and put them in the government's hands. Now, this idea works. I would be 100% for this idea if it turned out that government was a supernatural entity populated by angels from on high that involved no corruption, no ineptitude, no inabilities at all. Then I really would be fine with only the government having guns. But as it turns out, government is just another word for a lot of people. And if you start out with the thought that people are a bit useless, that they fallen angels, sometimes inclined to be good and sometimes inclined to be not good, then the same argument applies very much to government. And in South Africa, the argument gets bite. 500,000 people have been murdered in the last 25 years. The murder rate has been increasing substantially year on year for the last more or less a decade. So it's not as bad as things were in 1995, but it's bad. And if you compare us to international averages, our murder rate is something like 35 per 100,000. Zimbabwe's murder rate is something like 7 per 100,000. So this country is five times more dangerous than a place which I don't even think you can really call a country, but certainly is on our northern border. It's also the case that our murder rate is much higher than India, even though India has wealth inequality through the roof and on average is a much poorer place than South Africa. So poverty is not really going to explain it. Inequality is not really going to explain it. I think what does explain it is two things. One, pure hardcore political corruption. I mean, police that are so brazen that they call, that they sell guns to gangsters and run stock theft syndicates and so on and so forth. And part of it is that we don't have a system that translates shame onto criminals. It gets deflected and distracted by race politics and by history and so on and so forth. So people don't have the proper disincentives not to be criminal. I think those are the major factors. Now, I'm very concerned about one thing, and I'll finish with this. I don't own a gun. I've thought about it, but I find myself to be a less stable character than someone like Terrence. I trust Terrence with a gun more than I trust myself with a gun. I'm not really mature enough, I think, to wield a lethal weapon. But I do live in a place that's guarded by private security, and some of my family are also living in different places guarded by private security. Now, if you look at the legislation, it's right to self-defense and to defend another person. It's not absolutely clear because the draft legislation in this event is not officially being disclosed. But it might also be the case that this legislation will affect private security companies. And if you're listening to this, that'll probably affect your life. So I think you should very much care. I think the thin blue line defending us from criminals getting exactly what they want is, for the most part, private security. It's not my favorite arrangement, but given that's where we are, taking away the right to bear arms in self-defense or to defend another person could be a very serious thing. And in that regard, just bear a thought for the police. You know, there's a nice story coming from rural South Africa where the police station was being attacked. And so they did what any South African would do. They called a private security company to come and defend them. So just imagine how tough it's going to be a police officer if you can't call the private security guys because their guns have all been taken away. I think it's a disastrous scenario.
Terrence, some more thoughts on this? What can people do maybe to stymie this legislation?
Well, next couple of days, we've started. Next couple of days, we'll be rolling out a campaign to inform and to encourage opposition to this. It's a reckless, in a sense, a populist, and I think also a deeply ideological a policy move. People who may remember the 1990s when the ANC was ideological and paranoid as it is now, but a lot more eloquent, should go and page through some of those documents where there's this the sense that somehow South Africa is Cuba circa 1960 with all these counter-revolutionaries running around, about to launch a counter-revolution. And I think that there is certainly an element of that at play. But, possibly, probably more to the point, we have a state system that is simply not capable of managing crime. They've got, we've gone through phases where it was, there is no crime problem, to shoot the bastards, to, I think this gives the impression of trying to do something. And if you can, for whatever short term, focus the attention on licensed gun owners as supposedly being the problem, that is what state dysfunction does. Personally, I think that South Africans do not always have the healthiest of relationships to firearms. I think that's a very reasonable discussion to have. And I think that there is a great deal of evidence from around the world that can help to inform a reasonable discussion. The number of guns in a society is not in all cases proportional to the level of violence in those societies. It often surprises people to know that there's a lot of guns, for instance, in Sweden, the big hunting culture, and that the most heavily armed per capita state in the United States is Wyoming, which also has the lowest rate of murder. Country with the area of the United States with the lowest per capita rate of legal gun ownership is Washington D.C., which has, funnily enough, the highest rate of murder. So clearly there are other factors at work. I think that own a firearm comes with enormous responsibility, and I think that there is every right for the safety of society to have that strictly regulated, and to have those regulations enforced. Unfortunately, the system that we need to do it has never been introduced, and I don't think can be introduced with the state being as it is. My final word on this is that, having spoken to gun dealers, and so one thing that they really wish that they could that we could get right is a proper firearm registry. Plans at the beginning with the new Firearm Control Act was that they're all going to be linked by computer to the central registry. Every time a gun changed hands, it would change in real time. Well, that was you know, 20 years ago. So rather than trying to fix the real problem, you know, we go running after a side issue. Very sad, very stupid.
Yeah, but it is going to take effort to stop it. So go to irr.org.za, click on the first thing that you see. It's going to say stop the government from banning decent citizens from bearing arms, and read what we have to say. I think you will find it reasonable, whether or not you like guns. Yeah, this is a civil rights issue, and support our campaign.
Yeah.
And remember, every time some sort of intrusion like this happens, even for those of you who reckon, oh, great, you know, all of those, you know, alpha males with their gats, you know, this is ha-ha, something to laugh about. Just remember that this will not be where it stops.
No. Very good.
Very good to remember. All right, let us move on.
I'm not an alpha male. I'm cuddly.
Cuddly with a gat.
Do you touch my teddy bear? You never mind.
Right. So let's move on to another story, which is, I think, some good news. But there's some not so. There's also something to be taken out of this. So there was a story: 30 black farmers have been handled title deeds after sort of seeking them for 25 years. 30 black farmers in Tafelkop, Limpopo, were handed title deeds by President Cyril Ramaphosa on Saturday. The farms are, I think, totaling 189 hectares and are altogether worth 25 million rand or so. In April of 1994, the black farmers in this area wanted to basically get title deeds for a piece of land. So they investigated who actually owned the land. They found it was the Department of Public Works. And then there was a very long engagement with government to try and get these title deeds, but now they've been handed over. Cyril Ramaphosa said, you know, this is great news. And he went on to say, as we return the land, we now know that there are many people who want to work the land. We encourage as many people to enter the agricultural sector because it is identified as a pillar to grow the economy. So I presume that the proponents, Terence, of expropriation without compensation will say, look, this is the future we want. We want to give, you know, these black farmers who have been without land ownership, we want to give them a piece so that they can invest in it. And then this is, you know, righting the wrongs of the past and doing so many good things. What's wrong with that version of interpreting these events, this story?
Well, I think it's really a case of, you know, read the fine print. Actually, don't read the fine print. Read the big headline of the story to which this is the fine print. Yes, it's wonderful that I think it was 32 households received land after 25 years. So, you know, this isn't just to put this into perspective. You know, you buy a suburban house, you get a 20-year bond. You know, this is longer than paying off your bond. So that is a moment of celebration. It's to be it's commendable, and you know that we have as the president said, you know, we have people who can now take out loans and use this, you know, to develop, you know, to assist them in developing supply chains and, you know, make commercial deals and whatever. It's wonderful. It's fantastic. It would just be that much more wonderful and fantastic and meaningful if this was actually the general plan, and not as I say, a footnote or the fine print on a much, much bigger story. The government's plan, the government's orientation on this is that land is to be held by the state, land for redistribution. In other words, when you are when you don't have a particular historical claim on a particular piece. That's the restitution part, and ownership is possible there. But when, you know, you are an aspiring farmer who wants to get a piece of land to work or whatever.
Lost Terence there.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, no, sorry. You said you were talking about land ownership. You said when you don't have a particular historical claim.
Okay, well, you don't have a particular historical claim. This goes through the redistribution program. The entirety of that is premised on the idea that the state will own and will give you a lease. As former Minister Nkwinti said in the debate around the amendment of Section 25, he made it very, very clear. we are not going to give title deeds. I mean, you know, don't take my word for it. Go look it up on YouTube. He said, you know, we are going to make it available to our people. But our people and us are apparently sort of coterminous here. So we'll own it and they can, you know, sort of use it as long as they do it to our satisfaction. And, you know, then if we decide that maybe one of our people who might be like, I don't know, politically connected wants the farm, well, we can change the lease, which has happened. Now, the president, to his credit, did make some remarks about, you know, the challenges in land administration. It was pretty big challenges. Super big challenges. And what I'm getting at, and really what I'm getting at here, is that this is an anomaly. This is not policy, what we saw. And I think it is very dishonest if this is going to be portrayed as being as being the pattern that the government wants to follow. If indeed it is, then, you know, go and start changing those policy documents. Go and start saying actually we're about people owning. But they have been, I think, very, very clear, very consistent that this is not the case. The David Rakhase case, the government's own papers said that it's based on the principle that, quote, black farming households and communities, quote, should have long-term leases, not ownership.
Yeah, that is quite damning. And the fact that didn't cause enormous outrage apart from the sort of anti-EWC crowd, that the sort of mainstream didn't pick up on that is quite insane to me. Gabriel, your thoughts on this case, your thoughts on Ramaphosa's comments as well, that many people want to work the land?
Yeah, I mean, agriculture is directly 3% of GDP, let's say, which is in line with the developing nations of our nature around the world. And it only gets smaller the more we develop. So I think agriculture is very important. And in particular, I think if you gave title deeds to the 17 million South Africans living on government-owned land, then that would be a very good thing. But it's not the ultimate trajectory of growth. Most people want to get into the cities and find good work. So just, by the way, compare 32 households with 17 million people to get a sense of what Terence is talking about with the tokenization of this example. I think it's a very good thing what happened here. But it reminds me a little bit of an old Soviet story. Stalin was notoriously, there were some anti-Semites around, and they appointed one Jewish general to refer every time the Americans said, but you guys can't criticize us, you're anti-Semitic. They'd say, no, but look, we have a Jewish general. And the Jewish general would say, yeah, you see, look, everything's fine. his name is famous to this day. I'm not going to try and pronounce it now. In the former Soviet Union, as an example of just that thing, which is the little footnote, the exception, you know, that's drawn out to show that we're going in one direction, when on the ground, in the kinds of numbers that really matter, we're going in the other direction. And just one last thing. I mean, this is a case where the government owned the land the whole way along, right? So this is not a case of expropriation without compensation. The point is, you don't need EWC for the government to release land. You only need EWC for the government to get more land.
And apparently it took 25 years for the government to release land. So that's not a good indicator of the state of the bureaucracy, which is going to be administering all of this this going forward. So yeah, let's not fall for the I think the some of the good PR stuff here, because the program on land is not about ownership, it's about government control.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's just briefly go over our final story here in the last couple of minutes, and that is the DA's Leon Schreiber has said that the DA basically wants to get a hold of the ANC's CADA deployment records. These have been referenced a bit at the Zondo Commission. The ANC has this committee that decides on where it's going to deploy its CADAs in government and SOEs and that kind of thing. The DA is going to go to a court to ask to compel the ANC to hand over complete records of all deliberations and decisions taken by the ANC CADA Deployment Committee since the 1st of January 2013, when current President Cyril Ramaphosa became its chairperson. The DA says that it has been left with no choice but to approach the court after the ANC earlier this year refused to comply with an application they submitted in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So, Terence, what are they trying to do here? What do you think the likelihood of success is? And do such records exist?
Okay. Interesting thing, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, when it was passed, there was a lot of concern that this was going to allow, you know, the horizontal application, people to go, you know, looking at not state records, but of the private information. And this was very stoutly defended by people who I'd say were broadly within the ANC's camp, that information is power. And, you know, if there's a dreadful, you know, white monopoly capitalist firm dumping chemicals in the Vaal River, we've got to be able to go and look at that. It'd be something, in a sense, quite ironic about this act being used on the ANC. And I think, you know, within its spirit, that is entirely correct. DA's prospects of success really, I think, are somewhere between zero and bugger all. I think, first of all, I'd really doubt that there are records to access, in the sense that I don't believe that this operates with written records and paper trails and you know, a secretary in the corner who takes minutes and distributes them for approval at the next meeting. I imagine this is much more like you know, a couple of people meet in someone's office after work and throw and knock some names around, and then make a phone call. So I suspect that they're in a hiding to nowhere, and I also just wonder whether courts would be willing to try and compel it, and how you enforce it if they just decide that they're not going to. I mean, are you really going to send, you know, the Hawks in to, you know, arrest or Ramaphosa? I think it just strains plausibility. So but I do think that they are onto something, because I think this has probably been one of the most toxic, pernicious and disgraceful episodes of post 1994 South Africa. The way the ANC effectively took a key section of the Constitution in 1997 and publicly tore it up. And I think that we have never recovered from that. And I think, and every time President Ramaphosa opens his mouth about a capable state, should bear in mind the role he personally, as the one-time head of this body, played in destroying the capacity of the state to play anything like that role. And I think ultimately that, you know, Leon Schreiber is smart enough. I think he probably knows that he's not going to get anything. But it's a way that they can hopefully embarrass the ANC. But I suspect that that many in the media will be very cagey about the story, because I think that the person who stands to land with the most egg on his face is Ramaphosa, because it was under his tenure that, you know, many of these state capture appointments were made. And he was the deputy president, and therefore, apparently by convention, the head of the deployment committee.
Gabriel, in 6 seconds, your thoughts, if there's anything you have to
add. Yeah, well, I hope you read out the list of names that the DA mentions there of notoriously useless people who were appointed under Cyril Ramaphosa's tenure to major positions of power and influence, because I think that is the point. And the point that they try and raise is that Ramaphosa swore under oath before the Zondo Commission that he had no knowledge of these people's appointments. Mm. And so what they're looking for in those notes, amongst other things, is anything that shows that to be untrue. And if it's the case that Ramaphosa said something under oath that's not true, then you can take him to court for perjury. And yeah, I mean, Ramaphosa is the kind of guy who is never going to be guilty of out and out corruption in the way that the Zupta crew is, because he made enough money another way, but that doesn't mean he's above the law. And for people who suspect that the president sometimes talks out of both sides of his mouth, I think the ANC will do well to dispel that suspicion by opening up its books. What's there to hide?
Right. Yeah, so that list you mentioned includes people like Dudu Mayeni, Tom Moyane, Ben Ngubane, Arthur Fraser, Sean Abrams, and many more. a lot of people who I think have not had, shall we say, a good couple of years in terms of serving the public good. Anyway, yeah, I think that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening to us. Please support us, share us, like us, all those good things. Do check out our campaign about firearm rights coming soon. And yeah,
it's already up.
Sorry, it's already up. And we will see you tomorrow for the next episode of the Daily Friend Show. Thank you very much, everyone.